Support for Access Utah comes from Crumb Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches. Hello and welcome to Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me today is Diane Alston, USU's extension entomologist, and we're going to talk insects today. It'll be the last program we have before the next year, and I was thinking, Diane, this morning that, you know what, there's only about 2.5 more months and the days are going to start getting longer.
Brian.
Well, unfortunately for me, along about March or April, I think, oh, no, the days are going to start getting shorter. So I do look forward to this time of year, knowing the gardening catalogs are going to show up in about 2 months or earlier, depending. It seems like each year they come a little bit earlier. But right now we have some insects that we need to talk about. And one of the ways that as a listener that you can get timely information is by signing up for newsletters or advisories that come automatically from Utah State in the form of a PDF to your email. And these things are great. There was a newsletter that just came, Diane, entitled Utah Pest News.
Right.
And it was 14 pages long, but it had
chock full
of information and pictures that you can look at to identify some of your yard insect problems. And we're going to have a link on our homepage at upr.org for this. But if you want to go directly to it, it's at the extension website.
Right. So we actually have a couple of different kinds of outreach, public kinds of information, as you just mentioned. So one is a quarterly newsletter called the Utah Pest News. And so each spring, summer, fall, and winter, we have an issue that comes out. And as you mentioned, this last one that for the fall is a really big issue. We had lots of different good topics to cover. And you can sign up for this on our Utah Pests webpage. And that's at www.utahpests.usu.edu. Or you can just Google or whatever that and you'll get right there or go to the UPR website. You know, lots of different ways to find it. And then, as you mentioned, there's also these other seasonal advisory-type newsletters, and they're geared towards the different kinds of plants that we grow. So we have one for landscape ornamentals, one for turf grass, one for tree fruits, and one for small fruits and veggies. And these come more on an as-needed basis, so more frequently, of course, in the summer, spring and summer, during the growing season. But there will be a fall issue of our turf grass advisory coming out here soon, things to do to prep your grass to go to bed for the winter. So those also can be signed up. They're all free subscriptions. They come to you, as you said, an email with an attached PDF file. But also you can go to the website and look at all the archived issues, too. So if you want to look back and see, you know, what was going on in fall of 2011, you know, in terms of different pests that were active or things that were recommended, things to do, you can always do that. Or 2010, I think we have several years posted on there. So
there's a cornucopia of information. I always want to say that word on the extension website. Last week, someone had emailed us, and I didn't catch the question until right at the end of the program. So I emailed her back. She had wanted some information about carrots and how to store them. And so I just went to extension.usu.edu, mm-hmm. went to the gardening section, and just typed the word carrots in, and up popped several different pages of information. So
yeah, that's what we try to do. We try to make it very accessible, easy to find. We do our best. So please let us know if you are looking for something you can't find, and we'll try to help you out.
Well, here's how to contact us with your questions or comments. The toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can also email us your question. Just go to upraccess@gmail.com. Or you can also tweet us your question, and that is at #AUGarden. You can also follow us on Twitter, because I'll send out one or two timely tips each week, so I try not to overload things. And you can follow us at AU_ garden. All right. So, Diane, let's take a look at some of these insect problems that we've got going right now. Anyone who lives within the sound of my voice right now has probably got box elder bugs on their house. We've talked about them over and over. This year seems the spring, I didn't see any on my house. I had the best looking clematis I've ever had. This fall, my clematis has been munched down to almost nothing, and they're just flying all over the place. It looks outside my window here at work, and you can't walk in the building without one of them dive bombing you. So what's happening?
They're very abundant. Yeah, I mean, I saw a lot around where I live, which is around a lot of box elder trees, so that's where the main source is for them. All summer long, the nymphs are bright red, and they're often seen in little clusters on the ground or on box elder trees. They feed on the developing seeds, and that's where they get their nutrition, their primary source of nutrition.
So what are they eating on now?
Well, now the adults are, they just take advantage of different things that where they can get basically moisture is what they're looking for this time of year. But they're not into a heavy feeding mode now. But the nymphs are the primary feeding stage during the summertime. And so, yeah, I saw a lot of them throughout the summer. We knew we were kind of set up for a really big population this fall. And indeed, that's what we're seeing. They are a challenging insect to manage from the standpoint of keeping them out of your home, keeping them from congregating on your home, from being a nuisance. But one of the approaches we've talked about on this show quite a few times, and we even have a video fact sheet on our Utah Pests webpage if you'd like to see that, about using something as simple as making your own soap spray that you can apply to them, and they don't like the soap, so they drop from the structure, the side of your house, wherever you're applying it. But also, it kills a good number of them. It doesn't always kill them all, but at least it does deter them for a while. And doing that, you know, once a week or every couple weeks during this peak time of year in the fall when they're congregating on buildings, on your home, can be a real benefit to reducing the numbers. The problem I have at my home is that those that are on the side of the house, they work their way into the cracks and crevices, and then we see them all winter long coming, you know, into the inside when we have our house is warmer than the exterior. And so that's then the pest problem, is that they're there all the time and you're having to clean them up.
Now, I have used that soap solution before, and it worked really well for me, and it made it really quite easy. When this was in the spring, they were really massing and all together. And then just about every other day when I was on my way out to the garage where they like to mass, and on my neighbor's garage, and I got permission, I just squirt the heck out of the little buggers. And because the sun was up enough and the heat was there, the soap dried really quick, and it just kind of, I'm guessing, was just splitting their exoskeletons
as they... They have a waxy surface on their exoskeleton that helps protect them from too much water loss. And so that soap, just like it does when you use dish soap to wash your dishes in your sink, it's breaking down that waxy residue. And that's exactly what it does to the insect exoskeleton. And that's what happens is it cracks open or it has enough openings in that waxy layer that the insect desiccates and eventually dies. It may not die immediately, but they certainly aren't very healthy after that.
Well, and what I love about that is that it doesn't hurt anything else.
Right. So here's a cautionary statement, though, to say when, you know, technically as an employee of Utah State University, I'm actually not allowed to recommend anything that's not specifically registered as a pesticide for a specific pest use. And making your own home soap solution is not a
technically not
a registered product. So right up front, I'm saying I'm already kind of walking in a gray area, but here's some suggestions. I hate to not, you know, things that people can do on their own at home in an inexpensive way. Those are the kinds of things that we really like to advocate in an integrated pest management approach. And so I can't be too specific, but here's some things I can say. Please stay away from products that could damage the exterior of your home. So we've had some reports that when people use something like a dishwasher, you know, granular soap like a Cascade, or I'm not naming any brand specifically, but trying to give you an idea what I'm talking about. There were some problems with that etching glass. And so that is not the kind of product you want to use. You want to use a liquid dish detergent, soap. Actually, soap's better than detergent, but it's hard to find soap anymore. Something like a non-scented, non-colored. So we used to say something like an ivory dish soap was the best, but something that's very mild, that's not going to harm the windows or the exterior of your house. And if you have some kind of very special wood siding or something, you need to be cautious with that, and test out your soap solution first in a small area and make sure it's not going to cause any harm before you do it in a big way, because you don't want to end up with, you know, damage to the exterior of your home.
Well, and I can imagine the dishwasher soap can etch
glass.
So that it is that's a good cautionary
somebody used
measure.
It evidently at a pretty high concentration, and they had some damage to their windows, and so then they were unhappy that, you know, USU Extension had recommended using this homemade soap solution, and then they ended up with having to replace their windows. So anyway, I say all this with, you know, be very cautious and always try things out on a small scale first.
Okay, so with the box elder bugs, since nothing will eat them, or if they try once, they won't ever eat them again.
That's right.
There are some related pests that also have this same type of chemical response, mm-hmm. where birds or other animals will try to eat them and then spit them out. One of them I wanted to ask about is the fire bug, which had appeared in Salt Lake a couple of years ago.
Right.
Has it spread?
So that's an invasive from Asia. And the very first place, you know, Utah's got to be have some notoriety for something. Well, the very first place this red fire bug was ever found in the United States was Salt Lake City, Utah. About, I don't remember the exact year, but going back into, you know, 6-7 years ago, something like that. And so it was first found in the Sugar House area, and it spread from there. I've had reports of it from South Salt Lake, Southern Salt Lake County, and places like that. So it's obviously spread within the Salt Lake Valley. We are not yet aware of any incidences of the red firebug outside of Salt Lake County that I've had reports of or been made aware of, had samples come in.
But it sounds like it is spreading.
It is spreading. It's very much like the box elder bug and the niche that is the kind of the lifestyle that it fills. It's also a brightly red and black colored, so it has these warning colorations to birds and other animals that might potentially eat it, that it has these chemicals in it that are very distasteful, and so when things try it once, they often spit it out and they never try it again. They remember that red and black color as a warning. And so yes, it's another one of these box elder types. Another one that we've had for a while in the western United States is a totally different kind of insect, but the Asian multicolored lady beetle. And it is a lady beetle. It does feed on aphids, so it has a beneficial side to it. But it also has this bad habit of congregating on the southwest-facing sides of buildings and getting into your home in the winter and being a nuisance pest. And it's also red and black colored, or it can have different colorations, but it's a brightly colored insect as well.
So if I see them in the house and what I think is just a regular lady beetle,
this Asian multicolored lady beetle.
I've been feeling sorry for it. You know, it's like, oh, you poor little guy, and, you know, try to put it on one of my house plants last until the spring.
I have very rarely seen any of our native lady beetles overwintering inside my home. I've pretty much almost exclusively seen this Asian multicolored. And it was actually intentionally introduced by humans on the eastern part of the United States as a predator for different species of aphids, which it does do. And then just over time, it worked its way west, and so it showed up here
a while back. So why didn't they study it to make sure that this is exactly something that we'd want to have? It just seems like every time we try to overrule Mother Nature and help things along, it just goofs things up.
Well, you made a strong point there. Mother Nature is a strong force, and when we try to mess with that, oftentimes we end up causing more harm than good.
Let's take a look at another sort of insect along this vein. It's the elm seed bug.
Right. So this is yet another one of that same group of congregating, causing a nuisance problem. And it showed up this summer in southwestern Idaho, so west of Boise. And it's now been documented over into Malheur County in Ontario, Oregon area, and also some more counties more south, southwestern part of Idaho. It has not yet been identified from Utah, but we suspect it's only a matter of time. And this one is an invasive from Europe. As the name says, the elm seed bug, it feeds on elm seeds, but probably some other species too. And we're still learning more about what kind of host range it's going to have. But really, as far as a plant pest, that's not the main concern. The main concern is this behavior of amassing in large numbers, congregating on buildings, south side of buildings, and getting into homes and things like that. So it's expected that it's going to be doing that same kind of thing. Now here where we have box elder bugs so prevalent, you know, it's a little one of, as a entomologist and a biologist, a question that I think about is, well, I wonder, can these two really kind of coexist together?
Or, will one move
aside
the other population?
They're filling the same niche. I'm just curious, if we do see it show up here, will one of them kind of battle it out for the other? We'll see.
Well, why not get all three populations together and see what happens?
See what happens. I don't want them in my house. No, thank you.
Well, it seems like each year there's always something new that's popping up. And I don't know, I'm always in hopes that a cold winter will take care of things. And sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. For instance, with the Japanese beetle, that seems to have kind of been taken care of with a little bit of help.
Right. Well, I mean, certainly there was a lot of human intervention there to target decreasing populations, especially of the grubs, the larvae in turf and gardens initially. But I think they really learned over the course of the efforts of the Utah Department of Ag and Food in trying to eradicate this insect from parts of Orem and a few other places where it showed up, that the grubs in the turf was, you know, the real kind of major carryover factor. And so a hospital and a school that had a lot of grounds with turf grass on it, were they really focused in on, you know, keeping up applications of insecticides to keep those larvae from building up. And now after 7-8 years, it's been shown to be quite successful.
Did they find any this year?
As to my knowledge, no, they did not trap any. I haven't heard the final report for their trapping for this year, but about a month ago, they had not caught any, so it's unlikely they were going to.
I mean, this could be disastrous for pretty much everything. They eat everything.
Very,
everything
very
from
broad
roses
host range,
to corn,
yes,
to whatever. I would imagine fruit trees.
Yes.
I mean, it could
devastate. They're a big pest of apple and in the eastern U.S., yes.
I was visiting in the Boston area last year, and we drove up to Vermont, and I'd never seen a Japanese beetle, but I was looking at a flower bed, and I got a little closer, and they were all over the place. I know these are Japanese beetles. I've seen pictures of them.
Right.
Diane's done too well of a job of describing them to me, and they were just all over in the flowers.
I went to graduate school in North Carolina, where they're just very common, and people's roses are one of the most problematic plants that they have, where they have to try to, you know, do something. If you want to have any blooming roses, you've got to do some kinds of sprays or treatments.
And do you do a systemic on stuff like roses?
Yes. When I was a graduate student, actually, there weren't that many systemics registered then, but now that is one of the main approaches. Also, we were using a lot of traps, but the problem with the traps is it really brings them into that local area. So you don't want to put a trap right near where you have flower beds or fruit trees, because you could be actually increasing the populations. You have to have a spot that's kind of away from things.
So the neighbors a block away would probably enjoy it, because then you're taking them away from them.
That's right. Or we used to say, put the trap near on the border with your neighbor that you don't get along with, and make the beetles go there.
Well, we'd like to hear your questions or comments. Our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. Email us your question at upraccess@gmail.com, or tweet us your question at #AUGarden, because we're looking for that as well. Coming up with the cold, really, how does that affect the behavior of insects. So I'm not seeing as many box elder bugs since it started freezing here in Cache Valley last week.
That does slow them down. Certainly that what they're doing is they're seeking protected places to find warmth. So
is that when I'll start seeing them massing in the morning? They'll start coming out as the sun comes up?
Well, when it's warm enough in a location, that's when you'll see them massing, yes. And then as it gets colder, they start dispersing and moving into those cracks and crevices. So in general, insects are diverse in the ways that they spend the winter. So different kinds of insects overwinter in different ways. So the ones that overwinter as eggs or in the soil, maybe as a pupa, pretty much you don't see those insects around anymore. So a great example of that are grasshoppers. I mean, I might still see a few last lone adults hopping around that are just waiting to be killed from that frost, but they've already done their reproduction and they've laid their eggs as in little pod structures in the soil. Or some insects like the tomato hornworm, they overwinter as pupae in the soil. So they've already moved into that environment, and daylight is the big factor that actually stimulates them to move into that overwintering stage, more so than temperature. Because as you can imagine, some years we have a very mild fall, some years we have an early frost like we did this year. And so insects can't wait until it gets too cold, because then it might be too late. So they actually start moving into these overwintering stages fairly early on with the decreasing day length. But then there's insects like box elder bugs, lady beetles, squash bugs, for example, that overwinter in the adult stage of the European paper wasps. That's another good one. And these guys can, what they do is they've been feeding heavily this fall to build up their fat reserves. And then what they're going to do is seek out warm places to spend the winter. So in your outbuildings, in the cracks and crevices of your home, or in the case of squash bugs, they seek out debris on the soil that they can crawl down into, or if you've got a stack of firewood somewhere, it's a nice convenient place for them to spend the winter. But they have like a glycerol type substance in their tissues that allow them to withstand quite a bit of cold.
Antifreeze
is what it is. And then they'll come out on a warm day when it is sunny and take advantage of that heat, warm themselves up. Often they don't feed at that time because they're not using much energy. They're in a low metabolic state, but just want to get that heat, and then they'll crawl back into their protected spot, you know, as the temperatures decline each day. And so that's when you see these insects active in the winter. Most of the time, they're adults, and that's the life stage that can tolerate that cold weather. So insects have really adapted to different kinds of lifestyles, different ways to survive the winter.
And it seems like the larger the predator, the less it's able to adapt. The insects seem to adapt a little bit quicker, and maybe I'm just doing too much of a generalization here, but...
Well, I think part of the things that help them adapt, their body size is part of that, but it's their high reproductive rates. They, you know, can produce numerous generations often in a year, and so they can pass on those genes maybe more quickly. A number of insects are parthenogenic, which means that they don't use sexual reproduction, or at least not for all of the generations. Like aphids, they do in the winter, but not in the summer. And so those are all adaptive traits to be able to perhaps pass on that genetic information faster and be able to adapt very quickly. Insects are highly adaptive, and you know, we always make this joke that if the world were to end from a nuclear bomb or something, you know, insects would cockroaches or something would probably be one of the few species that would survive.
Well, they've been around a long time.
They have.
Well, we've reached the halfway point of our program. Diane Alston is USU's extension entomologist and will be with us for the rest of the half hour. But stay tuned. We have the next edition of Wild About Utah, and then we'll be back until the end of the hour.
Welcome to Wild About Utah, a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio.
This is Linda Curvin for Bridgerland Audubon Society. One of the largest minnows in the world, the Colorado pike minnow, was once found throughout the Colorado River Basin. This is no bait minnow. Also known as the Colorado squawfish, it reputedly grew to a whopping 6 feet in length, with a weight topping 80 pounds, and a lifespan of 40 years. The largest caught in recent times have been only 3 feet long and 9 pounds. Colorado pike minnows once flourished throughout the Colorado River and most of its major tributaries. Historically, these abundant torpedo-shaped fish were prized for their fine flavor. They were an important food fish for Native Americans and welcomed at restaurants as far away as San Francisco. Also called white salmon by early settlers due to their migratory behavior, pike minnows journeyed 200 miles to spawn in turbid backwaters. Then we built dams, which blocked the migratory runs of pike minnows. Below the Grand Canyon, the last wild Colorado pike minnow was caught in 1976. The proliferation of dams has drastically restricted their range. Moreover, reservoirs flood what was suitable river habitat, and their dams alter river flows and water temperature downstream. The Colorado pike minnow was one of the first fish given full protection under the Endangered Species Act in 1973. Today, there are two remaining wild populations. One resides in the upper reaches of the Colorado River system, the other in the Green River system. Efforts underway to restock Colorado pike minnow in the San Juan River Basin appear to be successful. A broadly based coalition of partners established the Upper Colorado River Endangered Fish Recovery Program in 1988. This program focuses on four species of fish: humpback chub, bony tail, Colorado pike minnow, and razorback sucker. Their goal is to restore and manage stream flows and habitat, reduce competition from some non-native fish species, and increase populations using hatchery-raised young. If they are successful, this giant piscine predator will once again take its rightful place in the Upper Colorado River ecosystem. This is Linda Kirvin for Bridgerland Audubon Society.
Wild About Utah is a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio. For transcripts and archived audio of Wild About Utah, go online to upr.org and click on the Wild About Utah link. Support for Wild About Utah on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our listeners and the Quinney College of Natural Resources at Utah State University, where students and faculty promote the sustainability of ecosystems and the communities that depend on them. Information at cnr.usu.edu.
Support for Utah Public Radio is provided by Weber State Cultural Affairs, presenting Jake Shimabukuro as part of his grand ukulele tour Saturday, October 20th at Perry's Egyptian Theater in Ogden. Details are at wsuculturalaffairs.org.
Welcome back to the second half of Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and with me is Diane Alston, USU's extension entomologist. Please join our conversation. Toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Email us a question, upraccess@gmail.com, or tweet us your question at #AUGarden. You can also follow us on Twitter. I'll send out one or two short timely tips a week, and that is at AU_garden. So, Diane, what new things showed up this year? Did you have anything else that we talked about, the elm seed bug showing up in southwestern Idaho?
So another issue that we had more problems with this year, that it's not a new insect to Utah, but we don't tend to see it on a regular basis, is called the chinch bug. And this is a small sap-sucking true bug. It's got a black and white coloration. We tend to see it more commonly in central and southern Utah, where it tends to be hotter, although it does occur in the north as well.
How big is it?
They're quite small, so okay. We're only talking...
flea beetle size?
A little bigger than that.
Okay.
Yeah. So quarter inch, something like that. They feed on a wide host range, but turf grass is one of the cultivated plants that we tend to see them cause damage to. And we had quite a bit more chinch bug problems this year than we have in recent years. We feel it's related to the drought that we have this summer, the hot, dry conditions that they like. And what they do is they feed on the grass, and they cause, you know, big brown patches that don't respond to irrigation. So when people, you know, first tend to see brown patches in their lawn in the summer, you know, your first thought is, oh, I got to get some more water on there. And if you, you know, then increase your irrigation, but you're not seeing a response, this was one of the, and there's other insects that feed on turf grass too, but this is one that we had quite a number of samples come in this summer and had inquiries about. And yes, we learned that, oh, chinch bug is out and active in turf grass this year. And so its management is pretty much just like any other turf insect, that the first steps are always to do cultural things to improve the health of the lawn. So, you know, proper irrigation, good fertilization program. If you've got too thick of a layer of thatch, that's the dead grass and the crowns of the plant that build up over time. Getting dethatching that, making sure you have good aeration into your the soil, that it's not too hard packed, so that you're not getting good penetration of the water and nutrients in. So all those kinds of things come first. Insecticides can be used, and the pyrethroids like bifenthrin is probably one of the most effective on the chinch bug. But generally, you do that as a last step, and you try to do the other things first and see if you can resolve it that way.
I know with our yard, as an official hose dragger, even though my lawn may not look as manicured as others in the neighborhood, I rarely have any problems with it just because I mow high. And that's when I do water, I water deeply, but you know, not too often. And so I think the roots are down and strong enough and the tops are tall enough that maybe an insect like the chinch bug just ignores my lawn.
You're doing exactly the right kind of management. And so that less frequent, longer watering so that you get deeper penetration, get a deeper root system on the turf grass. Those are all very helpful.
So were they've been here the last couple of years, just not showing up in northern Utah?
No, we really hadn't seen them. In terms of, oftentimes they can be problems more out on kind of rangeland grass and things like that. And we hadn't had samples submitted to the diagnostic lab actually for 6 years. And so this year they started showing up again. And again, it was concentrated in central and southern Utah, but we even had a few cases up north too.
So did they do they just tend to go dormant for a time? I mean,
they're around, but they're on, like I said, more on rangeland grasses and things that are, they like it hot and dry. And so they tend to not be as much of a problem in irrigated, you know, managed kinds of landscapes. But when we get into a summer like we had this summer with the drought, that's when we tend to see them show up.
So it's not like they're a cicada and they have a life cycle of...
They've been around
years,
just at low numbers. Okay. And then when they get into ideal conditions, their populations increase and we see them more of a problem in managed landscapes.
What did Mormon crickets do this year? I didn't hear
really
about them in the news.
Not abundant, and even there were a few hot spots for grasshoppers, but not like it had been. So, interestingly, you know, grasshoppers were some problems in residential areas, but in terms of on the rangeland and out in agricultural areas, more like, you know, in Tooele, Box Elder County, you're more removed from urban areas. There were only a few kind of hot spots. It was much less this year.
So the usual places did see a few of them, like Oak City and,
right,
and so forth. So.
But not a lot of, I mean, I'm sure there were some around, but not, we didn't have reports of very many this year.
Aphids quite
abundant.
High in populations.
Yeah, abundant
I'm seeing them on things I've never seen them before. As I was pulling up what was left of my cucumbers, they were just covered with aphids, and I had sticky honeydew all over my hands from it.
Yeah, so we're guessing that this just warm weather that we had, you know, just so much warmth during the summer just really was ideal for them to get in more generations this year and kind of come back with a vengeance, so to speak, this fall. And I don't know if you remember the last couple of falls, we've seen some large numbers of aphids flying aphids, so kind of clouds of aphids. And we're seeing some of that again this fall as well. Certain areas are reporting large numbers outdoors as people are walking and they're getting in their faces and so forth. And so there's many different species of aphids, but a good number of them, at least the ones that are our pests on our plants, they overwinter as eggs. And so in the fall, the winged aphid, the life stage that has the wings, male and female both, fly and to their overwintering host plant, which are woody plants, so trees and shrubs. And they mate there, and then the female lays eggs on the twigs that overwinter. And why we think we're seeing such high numbers is partly the summer. We had good weather for lots of reproduction. But also, we've been having some south, some weather systems that have pushed some aphids up from the south. So we're getting more up here in the northern part of the state that have been pushed up on these upper air currents. And aphids will migrate somewhat passively, but on these air currents, fairly high elevation. They've been able to trap aphids up pretty high, and they get blown into areas, and we think that's what's happening now. And then they get dropped down, and then we have all these clouds, little swarms of aphids flying around looking for woody plants that they want to lay their eggs on.
So the eggs overwinter. Mm-hmm. Do any of the aphids themselves overwinter? I'm just thinking, they're full of lots of sugar, so that should be some kind of an antifreeze for them.
They really don't. There are some species that have root-dwelling stages, so like the woolly apple aphid, if you've ever seen that waxy, white, woolly covering on your apple tree. There were little aphids underneath that, and that's called the woolly apple aphid. And they have life stages that actually go down into the soil and feed on the roots in the wintertime. So there are some aphids that overwinter that way. But above ground, really not much in the way of overwintering aphids except in the egg stage.
Okay, let's talk about then going from, as far as aphids, there's not really anything else you can do right now.
This time of year, you're wasting your time to try to like spray them or anything. Your plants are I had a hard freeze in my garden this last week, so really I don't have any cucumbers or anything left to worry about. And people say, well, should I spray them now on the fruit trees before they can lay their eggs? But generally, no, because there's been some studies to show that the number of winged aphids don't necessarily always translate or correlate directly to how many eggs you get. There's many factors involved. So you're better off to just wait till that delayed dormant time next spring when you would put on your oil spray and do that to your fruit trees or any of the ornamental trees and shrubs that you've traditionally had aphid problems on. Just wait till that time. You'll get a lot more, a more effective control at that time of year. So really nothing you can do now.
Now, with all the aphids that we've had, they've vectored some unfortunate
viruses. Yeah, we did saw elevated levels of virus infections in some of the vegetable crops this year. They're not new viruses to the area, but they're not often that common. And for example, there was a melon and gourd pumpkin farm in Box Elder County, Davis County areas that they just had were, some of the farms were devastated with this virus called watermelon mosaic virus, and it is vectored by aphids. And so in talking with the farmer, he said, yes, indeed, we did have a lot of aphids early on, and then the numbers kind of dropped down, and I didn't think any more about it. Well, then later in the summer, these severe virus symptoms started showing up, and a good proportion of this farmers' gourds and pumpkins became unmarketable, at least to the typical market, because they tend to be discolored and often bumpy and deformed. Unless you like kind of a strange looking gourd or a strange looking melon or squash, they didn't even pick them. They left them in the field. And so we're recommending to this farmer and people that saw that, and there were some of the same incidents of this virus, watermelon mosaic virus, in gardens as well, that next year that you make sure you have a good aphid management program. Also, there are some resistant varieties, and so we can find out more about that if that was a problem for you, to give you some good information to help you. But also, interspersing, so not having all big monocultures of the same kind of thing in one area, but planting them in rows or having a section of something that's less attractive and then having things that are more attractive to the aphids and the virus, and kind of mixing it up. Those kinds of things can really reduce the incidence.
I know as far as melons, and we talked with Dan about this last week, that the powdery mildew, and I've had people ask me, is it, what's that caused by?
It's a fungus.
Yeah. It's a fungus. It just depends on the plant variety. I've got a golden zucchini plant that doesn't have a bit of it on it, but right next to it is another variety of zucchini that's just covered with it. So
differences in susceptibility to that fungus.
So I'm definitely planting more of the yellow zucchini.
And with powdery mildew, at least in the home garden, oftentimes it doesn't really get going until late in the summer.
Yep.
And usually, I feel as a gardener that a lot of times, you know, by then I'm almost done with how many I've gotten, you know, a big crop, and I'm pretty happy. And so the powdery mildew comes in and kind of takes out the vines at the end. Oh, well, I'm not too worried about it. Now, I'm not saying that always happens. And if you're a grower that's trying to grow, you know, a big field of pumpkins and the powdery mildew moves in and your vines die down a lot sooner than, you know, the pumpkins aren't fully matured, well, then that's obviously a real economic problem. And you may need to do some kind of a fungicide application. Usually the home gardener can get away without doing anything about it.
But it does show, as you've said, there are varieties that are more resistant to these diseases that can be vectored by the insects.
That's exactly right.
Than others. So it does pay to do a little bit of research to find out, okay, what, and call your extension office and find out what gets grown well in your area.
That's exactly right. Yep.
We only have about 12 minutes left in the program. If you want to get in a question or a comment, and we would love to take it.
We would love to have a call.
1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can email us your question. The address is upraccess@gmail.com, or you can tweet us your question at #AUGarden. So what else have we got left? I was just thinking of the different things that were on this last Utah Pest News newsletter. I think there was, and you've got it written down here, blister mites showing up.
So generally these are more of a problem in home apple and pear trees than they are in commercial orchards. And these are a very tiny little mite that overwinters in the bud, so actually in the little scales that close up tightly and make the overwintering bud on the trees. That's where these mites overwinter. And they come out in the spring just as the leaves unfold, and they feed on the surface and they make these little spots, little blisters that at first are just green and a little bit bumpy, but then they develop into these brown blisters later in the summer, and the leaves don't look very good. And they tends to be very variety specific. I know in my home orchard, I have some apple trees that have a lot of this and other apple trees that don't have any. So very dependent on the variety. And there's a kind that attacks apple and a kind that attacks pear. And there's two main times to manage this blister mite. It's not like the summertime spider mite. But the timing are now in the fall, in October, just as the leaves start to show a little color, but before they drop, that's when these mites are moving into those buds to overwinter. And so you want to get them at that time. And the material that you use is not a very pleasant material to work with. It's sulfur. And it comes in flowable or wettable forms. It's kind of stinky, you know, what sulfur, like rotten eggs, smell like. It's not a particularly nice smell. And it's a little bit, it clogs your sprayer, and it's a little hard to work with. But there are some products you can buy, some sulfur products that are reasonable, and that's really what works the best on them. So right now, with a sulfur spray on any of these apple and pear trees that have these little blisters on the leaves, this is the time. The other time is in the spring. And in the spring, rather than using sulfur because it's kind of hard to work with, I usually use carbaryl, which is an insecticide that has sulfur in it. But sulfur works better. So in the fall, I really recommend the sulfur. And in the spring, if you miss that fall spray, then you could use a carbaryl in your just as the leaves unfold and start to grow in the spring.
But the sulfur, even though it's a little stinky, it's pretty innocuous. It's not.
That's right. It's not like harmful to you. It's just little nasty. It's just not as pleasant to work with.
When we have our first caller, we have Carla from Hyde Park. Hi, Carla. How can we help?
Brian, this is Carla. You know me.
Yes.
And you guys do such a great job on this program. Thank you.
Thank you.
I just have a question to see if the USU Extension has a class or a brochure on pruning shrubs, or if she can recommend a good book.
That's not my specialty as an entomologist. I do more with bugs, but I do know that USU Extension offers Master Gardener classes, and certainly one of those each year focuses on pruning woody ornamentals, so trees and shrubs. And I don't know if there's an actual fact sheet. Brian shaking his head, there is.
Yes, I've used it. If you go to extension.usu.edu, go to the gardening section and just type in pruning. You could even put in what type of tree you want to prune, the fruit trees or whatever. And I know that there's a publication that they have that has pictures and shows you where to cut. It's always better to find one of the classes, maybe just a demonstration, and be able to go to it and see how they're doing it. But they do have information on their website.
Wonderful.
And are you here in Cache County? That's right. You said you were Hyde Park.
Park.
So Ton Bettis, who is our horticulture extension agent, you could call the USU Extension office in Cache County and see if when they'll be offering a workshop or class. And a lot of times they use the master gardeners to help them do those classes.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Carla.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. Next, we go to Joyce in St. George. Hi, Joyce.
Hello?
Yes, Joyce. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Great. How can we help?
I have grapes, and I've cleaned them up now, but they were attacked by this worm, black and white, and I've never seen anything like it. It just decimated the grapes. Well, I've cleaned them up now, but my concern is, are my vines going to survive, or can I do anything for my crop next year?
Yes, and this is a kind of leaf miner that you tend to have problems with there in the southern part of the state. And the best things you can do, as you said, clean up. So these were on the leaves, and so you want to make sure that you rake up all those leaves that drop. That's important. But they will overwinter on the vines themselves. They insert their eggs under the bark. And so you would want to put on a dormant oil spray next spring before the leaves come out and start to grow. And that can be a good way to help reduce the numbers of this insect.
So, Joyce, did they eat the grapes, or was it just the leaves?
The leaves.
The grapes had been harvested.
Oh, okay.
Pretty much by the time, and they didn't seem to. I raised ornamental gourds and some other things, and they didn't attack anything else.
No, they're very specific to grapes. So, again, cleaning up the drop leaves, raking them up, and just putting them in an active compost or putting them in a green waste can to be hauled away, and then using a dormant oil spray next spring to kill the young as they start to emerge from those from the twigs are the recommendations.
Just go to the greenhouse and ask for a dormant oil.
That's correct. Yeah, and it would be the same kind of oil that you use on your fruit trees or your ornamental trees, any of those. Yep.
Okay.
Great. Thank you, Joyce.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You bet. Bye-bye. We have just a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to ask, because I haven't done it yet, there was, and I may have missed the timing for this, there was a spray for, is it the rose stem girdler or the raspberry cane borer? Crown borer, thank you, that's supposed to happen in the fall.
Also in October, right. So this is the one that kills the entire cane all the way down to the, right to the crown. So you'll notice just the whole cane is dead and it kind of snaps or breaks off at the soil line. And this is, we have three primary cane borers, unfortunately, in Utah, too many. But this particular one overwinters in the crown, and so it's called the raspberry crown borer. And so using a drench of the crowns with an insecticide, pretty much any of the insecticides that are registered on raspberries would be effective, but just making sure you drench that crown area in October is a way to kill
those
larvae before they go deeper down into that crown and root to spend the winter. And this is a insect that has a 2-year life cycle. And so it's important to do that, you know, back to back at least 2 years. Sometimes you might even need a third
year. Just in October or do it again in the spring?
In the October, just to make sure you clean up that population, because you're only getting a portion of it that's at that life. Some of them are at a different point in their life stage.
Okay. And how much drenching? When I hear the word drench, I think, copious amounts. But
yeah, pretty copious amounts. I mean, you don't want it if it's just washing, if it's so much that it's just, you know, spreading out and not staying right in that crown region, then obviously you're putting on too much. But, you know, mix up enough that you can be pretty heavy with your application, because you want it to soak in and get into that crown region.
So is it acting as a systemic? The plant is picking it up?
It's moving into that, it's not a systemic necessarily, like carbaryl is not a systemic, but you're putting enough of it around that crown area that the insect is, where it's just there on the surface and just inside, boring in, is going to be killed.
Okay. Well, in the next minute, what else, what other advice do you have to impart before you leave us for the rest of the year?
Well, I know in my garden, after I saw this heavy frost come this last week, you know, I'm looking out there saying, oh, I've got a lot of garden cleanup to do. And that's an important thing to do now. Go ahead and as you get time, go out and pull up all the dead plants, compost them, get rid of them. Don't leave them in your garden, because some of those overwintering insects like squash bugs like to, you know, they find a nice little warm place to burrow down in all that plant debris, they will do so, and you'll get more overwinter survival than if you get rid of it.
Diane, thank you for the year, and we'll see you again next
year. Have a great winter.
You've been listening to Access Utah. Diane Alston is USU's extension entomologist. She's been my guest today, and we'll come back again January or February, so we'll look forward to that. In our gardening calendar, the USU Botanical Center's Farmers Market is having an open house with apple tasting. It's this Thursday from 5 to 8 p.m. For more information, it's at usubotanicalcenter.org. And also October 16th from 6 until 7, the Botanical Center is offering a class on the best practices to keep a healthy green lawn and also how to troubleshoot a dry patch. Information or registration information is at botanicalcenter.org. And then October 13th, 20th, and 27th from 10 until 12 in the morning, Red Butte Gardens is offering a class on how to prepare your gardens for the fall. Cost is $66 for Red Butte Garden members and $72 for the general public. Registration information is at redbuttegarden.org. Thank you for joining us on this edition of Access Utah.
Looking for outstanding color and durability in your landscape? Consider adding one or more Amber Jubilee 9 barks. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. The leaves are a blend of lime green mature growth and shades of yellow and orange on new growth in summer, with all the leaves turning red and purple in fall. The colorful foliage is the result of crossing the purple leaf Diablo with the yellow leaf Gold Start 9 barks. This new 9 bark is less susceptible to powdery mildew and grows about 5 to 6 feet tall and 4 feet wide. It looks great in small groupings or large masses, making it useful for hedges, mixed borders, and low screens. Grow this in full sunshine for the best color. It tolerates a wide range of soils but prefers good drainage and is drought tolerant once established. This Canadian introduction is hardy in zones 2 through 7. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
Thank you for listening to Utah Public Radio. This is KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan. This is Utah Public Radio, Utah's favorite public radio station.
On the next Putumayo World Music Hour, we'll hear music from the tropical beaches and bustling streets of Rio de Janeiro. I'm Rosalie Howarth. Join us for Spotlight on Rio, the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Friday night at 10 on Utah Public Radio.